Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The first item on my newsletter today is BFDs. It's kind of a homage to Joe Biden, but I mean, we are now at 46,000, almost 47,000 American deaths. The number of reported cases, about 842,000. This morning, we learned that 4.4 million more Americans had filed for unemployment, raising the total number of layoffs since the pandemic to more than 26 million. Try to get your head around that. We haven't seen those kinds of numbers in our lifetime. And meanwhile, we have just the usual cascade of stories, including kind of a little bit of a troubling pattern. The president apparently does not want to liberate Georgia, throws the governor of Georgia under the bus. Now, he made the right decision on that, but I do think that it's a signal to Trumpian governors that the president will not necessarily have their back. We do have a little bit of the cognitive dissonance of the president's folks pushing to reopen the country, and then when you have the governor of Georgia saying, well, does that mean gyms and nail salons and all those other things that everybody thinks is ridiculous, getting their tattoos. Even Donald Trump says that's too much. But the troubling pattern in these three stories, which we will get to, Robert Redfield, the director of the CDC, gave an interview to the Washington Post where he said, you know, we could have a second wave of this and it could be worse. It could be terrible. The president spent much of the day saying, oh, he was misquoted. He's going to put out a statement. He never said that. At yesterday's briefing, Redfield steps up and says, I am accurately quoted in the Washington Post. Huh. Also, we have this story. If it's true, I mean, do you want to talk about a BFD? This health department official says, you know, doubts about the malaria drug led to his being fired. A New York Times story. Doctor who led the federal agency involved in developing the coronavirus vaccine said that he was fired after he pressed for a rigorous vetting of the coronavirus treatment embraced by President Trump and shilled for by Fox News. Doctor said that science, not politics and cronyism, must lead the way. So we do know the damage that whistleblowers can do. We also get this report from the Wall Street Journal that back in February, Trump wanted to fire another CDC official for having the temerity to sound the alarm. Back in February 25th, Nancy Messonnier said the agency was preparing for the pandemic and that it was going to spread, and the stock market plunged. And Trump, of course, was still in the mode of like, let's, you know, see no evil, you know, speak no evil. And he was furious. He's flying back to Washington from India, and he threatened to fire her for telling the truth. So, I mean, all of this adds to the confusion, the mixed signals, the credibility crisis all over this. And that's also just a reminder that anybody that challenges the president's, spin can be punished or made to atone, which doesn't bode well. So we're going to talk about a lot of stuff today. And our special guest is somebody that I have known, Christian Schneider. I think I've known you for 20 years or more. But the moment I say that, I'm thinking maybe it was longer than that. But hey, welcome on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And so, Christian, for folks we're introducing you, because this is your first time on the podcast. It won't be your last, I hope. Longtime Wisconsinite. We used to work for the same employer. You were the token conservative columnist for many years at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, then wrote for USA Today, and now you're with the College Fix. So it's good to touch base with you since we're in the same freaking state, Christian.
Yeah, it took us both going national to finally talk. So yeah, but yeah, we've known each other pretty much forever. I used to be on your TV show,
radio show. I know. And we follow one another, and I want to talk about the craziness that's happening in Wisconsin, because you and I have experienced the parallel experience of being part of the conservative movement in Wisconsin, knowing all of these folks, being part of that tribe, and then watching as, I don't know, did they leave us or did we leave them?
It's just, yeah.
And, you know, all these people, you go, hey, I used to be friends with that person. I used to think that person was rational and sane. So you had a great piece yesterday where you kind of raised your hand and said, hey, could we just remember here that the enemy is the coronavirus? It's not the governors. It was very, very timely, since now we're in this mode where the president has basically said, yeah, it's not my responsibility. It's up to you governors. And I really think you ought to open up the country. But hey, you're kind of on your own. And, you know, I'll cut you off in the knees if I want. So talk to me a little bit about what you see happening in terms of the right's decision to demonize governors.
Yeah, it really does seem kind of weird how he flip-flops back and forth between I have supreme control and, well, it's up to the governors to do what they want. So, I mean, it seems like the people in these states, kind of the red hat group, you know, follow what Trump does, essentially. They, you know, they follow his lead. And a lot of what he does is he always has to put a face on things to vilify it, right? So when criticism came down to him about how he was handling this whole thing, you know, it's the WHO or it's China or it's the media or it's, you know, he went after some governors right off the bat. He called Jay Inslee of Washington, I believe, a snake within the first week. So, you know, you have these people out there in the states and you have a virus, which is, you know, it doesn't have a face. It's invisible. It's out there. So how can we vilify the virus? And what they've turned to is trying to vilify the people that are actually trying to keep us safe from the virus, which are these governors. And, you know, even the furthest right governors at least closed schools down, you know, set some limits on when businesses could be open, all that stuff. And then, you know, you have other Republican governors like Larry Hogan and Mike DeWine that just shut everything down right off the bat. So, you know, they couldn't vilify the virus itself. It's funny when Trump says
he has to have an enemy, right? He's got to have a scapegoat, though.
Yeah, but did you hear when he went on this aside about how genius the virus is? Like the virus is so smart. The virus isn't smart. The virus does what the virus does. It's, you know, it's like trying to drive a nail and hitting your thumb and then blaming the hammer for being too smart.
The genius of the hammer.
Yeah. So you have the people in the states who now are coming after the governors who are merely trying to, you know, shut everything down in order to keep people safe. If they were to start to lift these things right now, obviously we would hear, you know, hotspots, people getting sick, it's spreading. And yet, you know, these people are, you know, it's understandable that they want things to open up, right? I mean, people are losing their jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
we're bored. We want to get out of the house. We want to do things.
Yeah. So as I said, in the piece, you can bring a job back, but with one notable exception, you can't bring a person back. Right.
Yeah.
So,
but it is interesting, and you in your piece you have some of the tweets from some of these folks from MAGA land who are just, you know, lashing out at the governor, saying they're purposely trying to destroy the economy just to hurt Donald Trump. Well, of course, this kind of ignores what, you know, happening in the rest of the world. But you quote this absolutely deranged tweet from Sean Davis, who is the increasingly unhinged founder of the Federalist. Let me just read it. Democrats and the media aren't demanding indefinite lockdowns for public health reasons. No. Democrats know the booming economy is Trump's biggest political advantage. So they made the deliberate decision to destroy tens of millions of jobs and livelihoods for their own political gain.
Because nothing fits on a yard sign better than I cost us tens of millions of jobs by shutting down. Like who thinks that governors are sitting there thinking these things? Like, you know what I could really do to help my reelection come November is shut the economy down and cost, you know, 25% of the people in my state their jobs.
Yeah, like, that's what Mike DeWine, Republican in Ohio, and, you know, Maryland's Larry Hogan were thinking. That was right, their calculation. Yeah,
right. They want to take down Trump. These Republican governors. Yeah. So when you vilify the governors, then you need to come to some sort of, you know, you have to ascribe them some sort of motive. Like, why are they doing this? And, you know, a lot of people are just like, well, they're just flexing their muscle. They want to show how authoritarian they are. And, you know, in some respects, you have Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan and you have some other people like Tony Evers in Wisconsin banned walking up to a window and waving to old people.
Yeah, that was pretty dumb.
Yeah. And so they do things like this. I mean, we're all still kind of feeling this out. I have sympathy for governors who are under the spotlights and, you know, trying to figure this out kind of in real time, right? But they are doing some things. Like Whitmer has people confused. People don't really know what's going on. And so it gives these people who are out there protesting now just enough to hang on to say, well, the gulags are coming because, you know, they're authoritarians and they want to just control us. And it just doesn't make any sense. Like, why would governors want to do this? Like, just so they can flex, just so they can, you know, show people who's boss. It just doesn't make any sense.
So let's talk about what's going to happen in Wisconsin tomorrow, because this is going to be one of the quote unquote big protests. And you've noticed this as well, that it seems like everybody's all in on this protest in Madison, Wisconsin, to open the state up right away. And it's not just, and I've made this point a couple of times, it's not just a couple of random people on Facebook, virtually the entire conservative infrastructure. I mean, all the guys, we all know them, you know, are all in on this. We have to open the state up, and all the big donors are out there. I mean, you know that the U lines are putting money into this, and Eric O'Keefe is there. Who the heck else? And I kind of wonder how this is all going to play out, because at least the polls that I'm seeing would suggest that most Americans are more worried about the coronavirus than they are about, and more worried about reopening prematurely than they are about going, you know, waiting too long, which would suggest that even though right now the Republicans are playing to their base and ginning up their base, this has a high potential to backfire, particularly in the areas where they've been having some trouble, like in southeastern Wisconsin and some of the suburbs. So I'm not sure that this is a genius political play at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the polling right now, and opening up the state immediately is way down there. So I think what you'll see is a backlash. I think you saw a backlash at the polls when, you know, was it 2 weeks ago, April 7th, they, you know, pushed through in-person voting here in Wisconsin in the middle of a pandemic, and their Supreme Court nominee, the favorite of Republicans, lost by 10 percentage points, because as it turns out, people don't like being forced to go out and vote in the middle of a pandemic. I think you might see that sort of a backlash, you know, when you see these protests start to crop up.
Yeah, I think that there's the real danger of this. Now, in Wisconsin, there's a dynamic there that Tony Evers is the Democratic governor. And just leaving aside the policy, he's not the most charismatic politician I've ever seen. He's not the most forceful, is he? I mean, the word feckless sort of comes to mind. He lacks this political gene that he drives Democrats crazy. So people need to understand that this is not one of the strong rising star leaders in the party. So, you know, to a certain extent, he makes a very, very attractive, punching bag for the Republicans. Also, now the Republicans in the legislature have gone to the state Supreme Court to throw out his extension of the order. And I just want to warn people on this. They're going to win. They're going to win, not just simply because Republicans control, I mean, the conservatives have a majority on the state Supreme Court, but also, and I actually sat down and read the brief, and the one thing that hit me, leaving the policy aside, was just how sloppy the Evers administration has been about all of this. So that's going to happen. It doesn't mean that the policy is wrong, but it's going to be a mess. So, you know, when I was sitting down to prepare for the podcast this morning, I was writing down, you know, a number of things that have happened in the last 24 hours. The Georgia governor, Kemp, who continues to be, I think, one of the dumbest governors in the country. Did you see the CNN interview with the mayor of Las Vegas?
I did.
Oh, my goodness.
Where she essentially wants to take the city of Las Vegas and make them the control group. Like, here's what happens if you just throw everything open and let everybody get sick. It's just appalling.
It is appalling. And the thing about it is, the more you watch it, the worse it gets, including when Anderson Cooper asked her, well, okay, so you're not even going to have guidelines for how the casinos should reopen. Would you go yourself to the casino under these circumstances? And she says, well, no, I have a family. was like, oh, the other soundbite that I can't get past is the old Wilbur Ross soundbite right in the beginning of this. When the pandemic was spreading in China, and he says, well, this is really, really good news for the United States because this is going to bring more jobs back. And you watch this on the day that the unemployment has hit 26 million. And the only thing I can say is the best people. We just have the best people in charge of all of this. And then the story that I don't want to pass over, and I know you're interested in this too, a really interesting piece in the New York Times that reminds us that people like Laura Ingraham and, of course, Donald Trump really had pushed the malaria drug, which you can pronounce, and I'm not bothering to learn how to pronounce. So help me here.
Hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine. Okay. So they were pushing this. And now that the studies are coming out showing it didn't really work, it's like sort of never mind and putting in the memory hole. But what a strange moment in American history. The president of the United States and much of the conservative media infrastructure were pushing a specific kind of drug, even though the doctors were saying, guys, we should only be using this in clinical trials. This is kind of maybe a little bit risky. And they did it anyway.
Yeah, I tweeted over the weekend that in my lifetime, this might be one of the most, you know, amazing things that I've ever seen in my life, that a president in the middle of a pandemic or at the beginning of a pandemic, he's probably watching TV or something, and here's the name of this miracle drug that's already approved for something completely different, for malaria. And he just decides to walk out and pitch this, because that's what he is. He's a pitch man. He's pitching Trump steaks, and he's pitching Trump vodka, and, you know, kind of all these other failed products. So that this is what he does. This is his livelihood. It's his go-to move. So he hears this thing and he goes out there. Only this time, you know, it's not steaks or vodka. He's playing with people's lives. Like, you know, if this drug, you know, he wanted to be able to take credit for it in, you know, if the drug actually did work. But, you know, now it's going to be memory hold now that we've figured out that it doesn't work. He's essentially, you know, he's a snake oil salesman.
It is. It's
everything comes back to him.
See, this is the line between parody and reality has really, really been blurred here, because if you were writing a script about what if America elected a snake oil salesman and was doing this sort of thing, people might roll their eyes saying this is a little bit much. And yet this is our new normal. And it may not even be the top five story that the president was pushing this unproven drug. But it is interesting. We use the term memory hole, how we just move on. You know, the president of the United States makes promises, says things that have no basis in reality whatsoever. And it's like, well, that's Trump being Trump and the drug thing. But what was interesting to me is it's one thing for Trump to peddle his snake oil, because he has done, as you point out, he's done this his whole career. Tim Miller had a great story in The Bulwark where he went back and reminded us that, in fact, he's done this before. I mean, this is what Donald Trump does. But to watch again, so much of the conservative movement go along and say, no, we got to take this seriously. Really? No. And it's like, you know, let's push back against anybody that raised doubts about it. And so you have Laura Ingraham, whose medical degree is from where? I don't know.
Yeah. Actually, Google University.
I mean, didn't she actually went to the White House and is like, you know, pushing this thing? It's like, what the hell? So that's why I think this story. And who knows what all the details are. Anytime a guy gets fired or quits, there's going to be a lot of back and forth and everything. But this story about this Dr. Bright, this Rick Bright, who was fired as director of Health and Human Services Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. I mean, he's flaming. I mean, he is going out now and saying, look, I tried to push back against this. By the way, there's some emails that raise some questions about how aggressive he was, but I just that's a caveat. But mm-hmm. But here's the guy who's for years, and apparently he's quite well respected, and he's basically saying, look, I was pressing for rigorous vetting of this drug, and I got caught up in the politics and the cronyism of this. I'm sorry, Christian. This seems like this is a big deal. This is one of those inflection moments. And I know it's always dangerous to say that with this president, but here you have key guy. at the key moment of this, the guy heading up the search for the vaccine saying, I was fired because I pushed back against the cronyism, the politics, and the bullshit.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, every time he was up there pushing chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, I would always just like immediately look at Drs. Birx and Fauci to see what they were doing. And I just want to know what's going through their mind, because they have to play this dance of, well, okay, he's spouting nonsense right now, but I'm doing my nation a favor by being here. And if I say anything cross to him, I'll be out. And so just kind of the dance that they have to do to stay in his good graces, but at the same time tell people, yeah, this is probably nonsense anyway.
That's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're both of them are going to have best-selling memoirs at the end of all of this.
Well, I wrote a piece, you know, about the Faucian bargain there, and I have to admit, I have real respect for the calculation that they're making, that they have to keep their head down, they have to bite their tongue, not to engage in self, not to be self-aggrandizing. See, it's early in the morning. But because they know that they need to be in the room to stop really bad decisions from being made. And if you know, Dr. Fauci can rationalize a lot of stuff, because if he had not been around, who knows how many more hundreds of thousands of Americans might have died. So, I mean, literally, it's a matter of life and death. But you're right. This dance that they're having to do, and watching Dr. Redfield yesterday. Oh, my goodness. You know, I mean, you know, this is the price you have to pay. That the coin of the realm is you must suck up to and praise the president and not be too overt in your criticism, because you know that bubbling out there, you know, in that same, you know, cauldron of those vectors of stupidity that are responsible for some of these protests, there's a lot of fire Fauci, fire Dr. Birx. You know, all of this is deep state stuff. And you get crosswise with the president and they will come for you. And you know that the president has a very hard time standing up to that kind of pressure. So they are walking this line. But here's the scary thing. And when I say scary, I mean literally scary, as opposed to normally when we say, you know, scary stuff. We are weeks away from these decisions to reopen businesses and communities, to reopen reopen whole states. And there are a lot of health experts out there who are issuing warnings saying, you know, if this thing comes back, it can be deadlier than the first time around. Here are the things that are really, you need to be concerned about. And yet we have this culture in the Trump administration where if you speak out, you can be slapped down. It is a speak no evil culture. And so how certain can we be that we are going to get the reliable information, that you can trust the decisions coming from the government at a time when that is vitally important?
Yeah. And at the same time, as I said before, you know, where's Trump on all of this stuff? I mean, one day he seems calm and reasonable. Here's our plan. We've got our four-step stage plan, and Fauci is there and Birx is on board. And then the very next day he's, liberate Virginia, liberate Michigan,
not liberate Georgia quite yet.
Yeah. And so then he swings back in the other direction. So I think what you've seen is, and, you know, as I watch this, I just think to myself, I mumble to myself, thank God for federalism, because we do have governors who are in control, who know what they're doing. You know, last week I joked that, God, if somebody would just set up a Twitter on the side where everybody just pretends that Larry Hogan is president, it would do a lot for my mental health, because he seems to know what's going on. He goes to South Korea and gets 500,000 kits, testing kits, because
amazing.
Yeah. I mean, if there's somebody that actually seems like he has the welfare of his own constituents in mind rather than himself, you know, it's Larry Hogan and Mike DeWine and these guys who are actually, they've essentially set up a shadow federal government where these governors get together in the National Governors Association and they do these plans and they try to coordinate. They try to do all the things that the White House is incapable of doing, because as you mentioned before, you know, people aren't going to want to speak up. People aren't going to want to plan if they run afoul of the president's wishes. So, you know, thank God for these governors who are getting together. They're just tossing aside whatever the White House says. They're like, look, Congress, federal government, get us the testing kits. This is what we need. Everything comes back to testing. You know, we can't reopen unless we know where the virus is, who has it, and, you know, who we can quarantine so everybody else can be safe. That is, it's testing, testing, testing. Everything comes back to that. Federal government, get on it. And we'll handle the, you know, we'll handle the closures. We'll handle, you know, trying to get these businesses back up and going, trying to get the economy going. But even when they do that, as you've seen with polling out today, people aren't going to be ready to go back, you know, no. to restaurants and, you know, a lot of what they're doing right now, they're doing on their own. I mean, if you ask people just randomly within, you know, within America, what their specific stay-at-home order says, they probably have no idea, but they're doing it on their own. They're doing it because they actually care about other people, except for these people who want to go out and protest and become a hotspot. So,
yeah. By the way, speaking of the people who are protesting, you saw that sign. I think you might have tweeted it out. Maybe it was from Ohio, where somebody's holding a sign saying "Sacrifice the weak, open up the state." Do you think that was real? Because I don't know that you can tell anymore.
I hope it's not. You can't tell anymore. People are just willing to say anything.
It's kind of Sacha Baron Cohen. You know, this way, I wish he was out there with a camera right now, you know, leading chants, yeah. Sacrifice the weak, and watching to see whether or not people would go along with it. Okay, you made a really interesting point a few minutes ago about the psychological effect of listening to Larry Hogan. And I think part of the stress of going through all of this, and you know, it's inherently stressful enough with the pandemic and the economic impact, but the overlay of Trump's deception, you know, narcissism, the, you know, back and forth. I mean, that really does add to the level of anxiety, because there is kind of that psychological when you do listen to a Larry Hogan or, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, a Chris Cuomo. I was actually sitting out in my yard the other day, listening on Sirius XM radio to one of the Cuomo briefings, and he's being
self.
Andrew Cuomo. Did I say? Yeah, I think I've said Chris Cuomo before, haven't I? Okay, Andrew Cuomo. Yeah, forget Chris Cuomo. I know Andrew Cuomo. There's so many Cuomos. At least I'm not referring to him as his father.
Chris Cuomo rose from the dead, so you know you should have respect for it.
Okay, so Andrew Cuomo. All right, so this is the psychological effect of all of this. So I'm listening to him, and I'm thinking, and he was self-effacing, and he was factual, and he was conversational, and it was, I learned about what they were doing. He explained what he could do. He admitted failures. He admitted the flaws, and then described what the strategy was going to be. And I have to say, it did have that psychological impact. Like, wow, this is what it would be like to live in a normal America. This is what it would be like to listen to somebody who is not demented, you know, at a time of crisis. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the second to last thing I wrote for the Bulwark was, you know, Trump has identified the real victim of you know, the coronavirus scare, and it's him. Because everything is about him. He's renting space in all of our heads when we could be out there actually solving this thing. And I think that's what governors are doing. You know, Trump stands up there and it's, you know, how many times can you hear him, you know, rip the media? And in some respects, he's actually fair because, you know, they haven't done the greatest job in some respects as well. But for him to just like, you know, air all his grievances against CNN and then, you know, laugh when he finds out Mitt Romney is self-quarantining.
Oh.
And, you know, just over and over, everything is some new headline about Trump himself, and very little of it is about how we're actually going to solve this thing. And it's just, you know, it's such a relief when Fauci or Birx actually gets up there to speak. Although in some respects, you know, they're being asked to comment on something ridiculous that the president just said. So you just see them squirm.
No. Okay. So we have to talk about this, though. The whole thing with masks. Are you wearing a mask? Do you do the mask thing?
I went to Costco yesterday, and yes, I wore a mask.
Okay. So, but I saw from your tweets that you have one of the same issues that I have, and so I need your advice on all of this. I wear glasses. and the fogging up of the glasses. I tried to wear a mask the other day, and I was not able to do it without my glasses fogging up. So as a long-term solution, how are you handling that? I'm sorry, okay. By the way, this is serious. You know, if my future is that I got to walk around with the mask, I want to be able to do it in a responsible way, and it's not going to work if I can't see.
So this is not a new problem. As you've probably seen from my tweets, one of the things that I like doing is like digging back into newspaper archives and finding stuff about like the 1918 Spanish flu. And there are ads in these newspapers for like dish soap that they say you rub on your glasses when you're wearing your mask so they don't fog up. This is literally a 102-year-old problem. So if I find anything like that, I'll let you know. I was walking around Costco with a mask on yesterday. I just had to take my glasses off and just bump into stuff.
Really? Okay.
Because I couldn't see. So yeah, we need to figure this out. I posted a picture of myself wearing my mask, and somebody says you just need to fold the top down further. I tried it. It didn't really seem to work. So I don't know. It's, you know, it's the price we pay.
Yeah, I'm also jealous. You went out and bought yourself a new bike to get out of the house, right?
I did. So the coronavirus, but
it's too cold. You know,
well, mid-40s, I think is okay. So coronavirus has done the impossible, which has gotten me to join the ranks of the bikers who I've loathed my entire life. I used to refer to them as the spandex mafia because they just go and they hog the roads. But now I've actually joined them. The problem is I got this new bike and it's a Trek bike. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. The problem is, it's so good. It's so fast and it's so light that it gives you like less of a workout than the old bike that I had, which is like a 20-year-old, you know, department store bike that I actually got from a friend. I traded him a baseball glove and he gave me his bike. So you actually get less of a workout. You burn fewer calories. Because you go so much faster and it's easier to pedal. So, you know, it's a trade-off.
It is funny that you mentioned that because I have two bikes, one of which is a road bike that, I mean, it absolutely flies, but you're right. It doesn't necessarily require a great deal of effort unless you're going uphill. And the other bike, which is more of a hybrid, does give you more of a workout. And I'm really looking forward to getting out. But, you know, you and I live in Wisconsin and, you know, the last week or so, there've been a couple of days that have been nice, but it hasn't, you know, cracked that. I have a hard time going out when it's really, really cold. But that's going to happen. We're all doing this. Okay. So I'm now sort of going back to the beginning when you were talking about, you know, Trump is always looking for someone to blame. And right now it's beating up on the governors who are going to be incredibly convenient for him because if things go well, he'll take credit. If things go badly, he will point the fingers at the governors. And so he thinks he's positioned himself perfectly because in Trump world, the buck never stops with him. The other major strategy is going to be blaming the Chinese, who is just not, I mean, that's good. But in terms of like the, you know, the big stuff, go back to the blaming some foreign country and China is kind of perfect. We put up a video a few minutes ago on the Bulwark, and I mentioned this on the podcast yesterday that we have a whole section on the Bulwark with all the timelines of when the president has downplayed this, what he said about it, when he's lied about it. We also have videos. So our Barry Rubin and Tim Miller have a new video up that I strongly recommend that you watch, and it's about one day, February 7th, a day that will live in infamy. And they write, February 7th is the day that changed the world. It's the day that defines the Trump administration's failures on COVID-19, a day that will shape the campaign around the president's reelection. Let's just play the audio of this.
On February 7th, 2020, three things happened that will define President Trump's failures in responding to the coronavirus. First, at 2:58 a.m., Li Wenliang, the brave Wuhan doctor who blew the whistle on COVID-19, died from the virus. In America, news of Dr. Li's death is a wake-up call to the extent that the Chinese were covering up the seriousness of the virus.
Li Wenliang has died today after contracting the virus himself He was detained by authorities for reporting on the spread of the virus.
Next, at 11:16 a.m., President Trump briefs the press outside Marine One. He's asked about the Chinese government transparency with regards to COVID-19.
Are you concerned that China is covering up the full extent of coronavirus?
Late last night, I had a very good talk with President Xi. I think they're doing a very professional job.
The president's answer comes straight out of China's propaganda playbook, but it wasn't just Trump's words. At 12:41 p.m., Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announces that the United States has sent China 17.8 tons of personal protective equipment. That's 17.8 tons of masks, gowns, gauzes, respirators, equipment our healthcare workers would soon desperately need. On February 7th, America got a wake-up call in the death of a brave Chinese doctor who tried to warn the world about the coronavirus. Trump ignored it. That same day, he praised and defended the Chinese Communist Party and sent them loads of the medical equipment that our doctors and nurses would soon need.
Whoa, Mr. Schneider. You know what? Joe Biden's got to hire Barry Rubin and Tim Miller. I mean, are they doing anything as good as that? Really?
Tim's been doing a great job with the timelines where you can actually just go back and kind of relive in real time. How Trump ignored this and downplayed it, you know, even though now he says, well, I took it totally seriously. I did the ban from China, the travel ban. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people came here after the ban. So it wasn't a total ban. And this is a good corrective to that.
Well, yeah. And for people who think that we're just going to wrap China around Joe Biden, bring that one on, because this the record is clear. I think that one of the things pretty obvious is that over the next couple of months, we're going to have a really battle over what we remember and the revision of history. And I think it's going to be an interesting back and forth, because we used the term memory hole a little bit earlier. But this is so powerful because February 7th is a very early date. And afterwards, you not only have Donald Trump praising and sucking up to the Chinese on numerous occasions. Jim Swift did a great piece about this as well. But of course, we had weeks and weeks and weeks of Donald Trump downplaying it. And this time around, there is videotape. Okay, so one last thing, because we're running out of time here. So, Christian, you were very much a fixture of the conservative movement in Wisconsin. You and I had different roles. You had the more respectable role as a newspaper columnist. I was a radio talk show host. But, you know, it's very striking what's happened to the Republican Party in Wisconsin and the conservatives in Wisconsin. Because I've told people, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that we were distinctive at one point. It was the Paul Ryan sort of wing of the party. It was very, very non-Trumpian. It was idea-based. It was reform-based. And now it has become really, I would say, almost completely Trumpian. I may be wrong. Give me yours. What was the most surprising thing that you've seen happen to Republicans in Wisconsin? And why do you think it happened?
I mean, this is the kind of the Paul Ryan party, is the party that I grew up in yeah. Wisconsin politics. You know, I worked in the state capitol for 10 years, beginning in 98 when Paul Ryan was first elected. And, you know, I kind of always figured that, you know, the Republican Party, the party that I knew, you know, they wanted lower taxes, they wanted less regulation, they wanted all these creative new things that that Paul Ryan was pushing. And then as Trump hit, I think for me, the canary in the coal mine was the first polls I saw on birtherism on Obama, where it said, you know, half or more of Republicans thought that Obama was born in Kenya or, you know. And I was just like, oh, well, that's a bad poll. What are they taking this poll in Alex Jones's basement or whatever? And, you know, I just kind of blew it off. But then another poll comes, and then another poll comes, and you're like, wait a minute, this isn't the Republican Party I know. And yet it seemed to be out there. It seemed to not be the party of Paul Ryan and Scott Walker and these people, but instead kind of these crackpot conspiracy theorists. And to your credit, you wrote about this in the magazine that we both wrote for and warned us all about this. So, you know, fast forward to 2016 and you see all these, you know, Republicans who are anti-Trump And then as soon as he gets the nomination, you know, Ted Cruz like blasted Trump in Wisconsin. Scott Walker actually endorsed Ted Cruz. The full Cruz press was on. I believe that was right around when he picked Carly Fiorina as his vice presidential candidate. And then, you know, as soon as it was clear Trump was going to be the nominee, everything just switched. You know, I wrote a particularly aggressive piece about Paul Ryan. I was so frustrated that he finally endorsed. And so it became clear to me that, you know, everything that I thought the Republican Party was or that conservatism was, it's not about, you know, these issues. It's about being in power. It's about our guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We don't care what it is. We just want to be in charge. And as soon as it became the party of Trump, everybody just fell in line because they wanted to be in charge. And that's why they're all continuing to fall in line. And that's why somehow, you know, being a conservative now means sending people out into a pandemic to get sick. And I can't believe what's happened to the party.
No, I can't either. You know, and I think it's you can't overstress how tribal our politics became. I've been trying to think through all of this without much success, I'm afraid, except for the explanation you came up with there. But, you know, the whole Walker Act 10, the massive protests in Madison, the recalls, that really hardened the political lines. And I think everything became a little bit harsher and a little bit more, you know, life and death, and maybe contributed to that you must stay within your lane. You must stay within your tribe, because, you know, before that, there was a little bit more give and take. Now, you live in Madison, so you have to engage in the give and take. You live right there in the most liberal, you know, county in the state. But that after Act 10 and after the recalls, the tribalism really hardened. And I was certainly part of that as well. I mean, remember all the court cases, and it felt like every day you were, you know, in battle, every day was a fight, and the other side hated you so much, and you hated the other side so much, and this has been transferred over into Trump world. I didn't see that coming, but I think that was part of it. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, and I think a lot of this is being abetted by talk radio, whereas, you know, the Act 10 stuff where you were around and, you know, talking about talk radio. I mean, what people don't understand when they say, oh, well, the Bulwark is some lefty rag or whatever, they don't understand the bullets that you took for decades for the conservative movement, and that you deserve credit for. And, you know, you decided to retire, and now talk radio in Milwaukee and Madison is just all screeching about, you know, the virus. And you know, nobody understands radio more than you do. And so it's probably boring to go on the radio. No talk show host wants to go on the radio and say, well, you know, Tony Evers has a point, and, you know, we really should stay safe. The ratings really come from people who feel that their opinions aren't being represented. And in that case, these are the people that want everything to open right away. And so, you know, a lot of these people are my friends, and I don't know that I'm going to be able to look at them in the same way ever again.
No, I know exactly what you mean. And it's true. It's true. It's you know, people will say, well, the talk radio hosts drive public opinion. Well, they also follow it. And after a while, I said this in 2016. I mean, I voluntarily retired. I had another year on my contract, but it was a great decision to get out. Getting was good, because I knew that the audience increasingly wanted to hear what it wanted to hear, that a lot of conservatives wanted talk radio to be the safe space. And you put it well, they wanted the ammunition. They wanted to be riled up. They did not want to be challenged to think, yeah, this Democrat who you really, really hate might be right on all of this. No, there are ways of doing it. There are some who've just gone all in on the Kool-Aid and will defend anything Trump says. The safer space is anti-Trumpism, which is you just keep attacking, you know, liberal Democrats, or you attack the media, and that's the formula. But it has been remarkable to live through, and you're one of the few guys that I think knows what it was like here in the Midwest. So, who do you think is going to win Wisconsin? I got to ask you while I got you on.
Who is going to win Wisconsin?
Yeah. See, I hedge and say, hey, it's really, really important, and it's going to be close.
Yeah, you mean in terms of the presidential race?
I mean,
we saw all the polls, the Clinton. What we've determined is that people here really don't like Hillary Clinton, and maybe they like Joe Biden a lot more. So it's just funny that, you know, in 2016, all the polls were wrong, and yet here we are ready to rush headfirst back into the polls. Maybe there's still a lot of people out there that like Trump that won't answer a poll saying that they do. I don't know. I'd have to say Biden has the edge, but, you know.
I think so, too. And I will tell you the one development that I think is the most interesting to me are these wow counties around Milwaukee, which was basically my backyard, Ozaukee, Washington, right, and Ozaukee, and the erosion of Democratic support in those counties. I mean, this used to be the beating heart of the Republican Party. You don't have to do anything to gin up enthusiasm in Dane County, where you live, or Milwaukee County. Right. Democrats, I think, are going to turn out. But Republicans used to be able to counter much of that by the suburban Republican vote, and they've been losing there. And if that continues, they have some real problems. And the fact that that Supreme Court race, and I understand all the problems about extrapolating, but that had to be a huge warning sign, because I don't know anyone in the state that thought that that was going to be a blowout for the liberal candidate.
It wasn't quite the upset that people thought, because, you know, as you remember, Republicans were trying to separate out the Democratic primary from the Supreme Court race, because they figured it would just be all Democrats showing up at the polls. And I think, you know, Democrats probably aren't going to get the spike that they need from the convention. I don't see any way that the convention is going to happen in any real way in Milwaukee. And so,
is disappointing. Whatever. I was looking forward to that, but I agree with you. Right. I think that Biden has is an edge. But no, I kind of built my whole year around that convention. That was going to be a big thing, and this was a big thing for a town of Milwaukee's size. Maybe too big for Milwaukee, but I agree with you. I don't think it's going to happen. So,
and we're probably going to miss out on a Bucks championship as well. So that's also
That's the thing, is you try not to get your head around all the things that we're missing out on. And so I understand people. I mean, we are, you know, this was the year that the Bucks, I think, could have won the NBA championship, right?
Yep.
We're not going to. We lost March Madness, which was shocking. The Brewer season. I mean, I really, really willing want to listen to Bob Uecker on the air. All of this. It's there's so many things. Do you remember your senior year in high school, how cool that last semester was?
Yeah, I pretty much gave up.
Yeah, well, no, everybody did. But it was kind of cool. And a lot of people are losing out on all of that. So on that note, hey, Christian Schneider, it is so good talking with you again. And just remind our listeners about your book, which is absolutely hilarious and funny. And I want to give you a shout out for that.
Well, it's a book I put out last year. It's called 1916, The Blog, and it's essentially about what if somebody had a blog in the year 1916? What if that technology existed? I went back and I read a newspaper from every day of the year 1916 to see what people would be talking about. And I think it's a pretty good commentary on where we are today.
Oh, I think it's excellent and it's hilarious, and I strongly recommend it. So, Christian Schneider, thanks for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.